You may remember last time one of the important points we considered was that the root of calm was the observance of the simple moralities. All the great teachers emphasized what in common parlance we call moral conduct of body, in speech, and in thought. All three aspects. The calm and insight, which is spoken of so much in Buddhism, depend upon each other. Without calm, it is difficult to have true insight. Although we occasionally get flashes of insight as such. But to be a person of such a nature that he always sees with insight implies that inwardly he has a basis of perfect calm. And this calm does not become part and parcel of our nature, at the heart of our being, so to say, unless our daily life is one which observes the simple moralities. We have considered this matter several times, particularly the difficulty in observing the simple moralities. Of course, we obey the laws of the land. We don't kill our neighbor. We don't steal, and so on. But that is the external physical aspect only. And as far as the physical aspect is concerned, we have a great advantage. If the desire, the passion in anger to slay the next person arises, we have time to say to ourselves, "Oh no, this won't do, my boy." And we refrain from it. Because we are aware of this passion driving us to wrongdoing. But we cannot be aware of the thought and the feeling before it has arisen. This is the difficulty where the inner life, the life of the mind, is concerned. All our thoughts and feelings seem to be instantaneous uprisings or reactions to stimuli, whether they are obvious stimuli or not so obvious. And we become aware of them after they have arisen. The case of the physical act, we cannot think about it. We can't think about thought. It has arisen. It is there. The mind has functioned like that, so to say. And all the great religions have emphasized unequivocally the necessity for this inward morality. You know how Jesus says, "Whosoever looketh after a woman with lust in his heart has already committed adultery." Now you see, there is the problem. There is a stimulus, a sense impression, or there is a memory uprising of the past, whatever it may be, and there is a reaction from the mind. And man's life consists basically of his mental life. If the mind is not operative, the body will perform its natural functions, of course, but our life will not be what we commonly recognize as our human life. And therefore the mind becomes fundamentally important. The moralities apply first and foremost to the mind. And therefore the whole field of motives, intentions, and so on comes into the story. Moreover, the mind is so very important because, on the one hand, it is that which deludes us. It cuts us off from awareness of the truth, of the transcendent reality, of things as they are. By a transcendent reality, I don't mean necessarily only that which is outside what we perceive through our senses, but the whole of reality. Now the mind is the thing that deceives us. It is the great image maker. And above all, the mind as we exercise it, more or less in our daily life, is the slave of our desires, of our passions. It's tied to them. The driving force is desire. The mind, the brain is just a computer machine that does all the slavery in subservience to desire, whatever the desire may be. So that's one aspect of it, but there is the other side. The mind is the indispensable link between the transcendent and us here. Now, I've put it in dualistic terms, which are misleading terms. The reality, the totality, is one and one only. It is that oneness, it is that harmonious wholeness, which is not yet the state in which we as human beings function. And that is what is emerging through human evolution. Now, this mind, this activity of the brain, and all that the activity of the brain has brought about, which we call mental functioning, on the whole has been the divider. It keeps the transcendent apart. When we have beliefs, however sincere, however deep they may be, in God or the transcendent or the infinite or the absolute or nirvana or the kingdom of heaven or whatever it is, they are but beliefs. They are not realities. If they were realities in our life, then the transcendent, the infinite, would play its part in our life as a matter of course. There'd be a quality of course-ness about it. If somebody asks you, what is that object? You say, oh, it's of course a chair. It's of course, absolute fact. There's no question about it. Now, when that harmonious wholeness has that of course-ness about it, man as man has flowered out into his full humanity. The Son of Man is identical with the Son of God. So the mind becomes tremendously important. Again, we use the term the mind, but perhaps it would be a little more accurate say mental functioning. We talk like this, the body, the mind, the spirit, and so forth. We separate them all out when we talk like that. And the tendency is to picture them as separate things. This is not the case. Reality is one. We are awakening to that harmonious wholeness, which is the one reality, the ultimate fact, the supreme truth, God. Use whatever word you like. And this awakening is very, very difficult, because this mind plays this part. Now the great teachers, all of them, we have considered this several times before too, never produced systems of metaphysics or philosophy or anything like that. The greater part of their work was devoted to telling us just to be simple, kind, good, truthful, and that's all. The ordinary Sunday school stuff. But you see the importance of it. If that can become the reality for us in our bodily and mental functioning, the harmonious wholeness is there. The very basis for calm, stability, insight, wisdom, perception, knowledge, the very basis for life to express itself freely, unimpededly through us as fully fledged human beings has been established. This is the importance of it. How easy it is for us, especially in civilized, advanced societies, to devote all our mental effort towards discussing, towards acquiring knowledge, learning profound things. What is there profound as compared with anything else? This carpet is as profound as God himself. What is the difference? Reality. Or rather, put it the other way. This carpet in relation to reality is just the same as God in relation to reality. We don't appreciate that sort of thing. See, our minds are separative minds. We make grades and hierarchies and all the rest of it, which apply. Once you have a limited context, if you have a limited context, then you can compare. But if your context is the infinite, you cannot compare. God, the truth, the totality, love, wisdom, whatever it is, in its perfection, in its fullness, is always incomparable. That is why, if I see any one human being truly and fully, and any other human being or anything else truly and fully, each one is completely incomparable. It's the one and only. It's reality manifesting through that. It completely is subsumed in reality. Reality holds that totally within itself. And reality never becomes more, never becomes less, is never greater, is never lesser, and so forth. Reality has a transcendental ethic about it, in which all our good and evil is wiped out altogether. But our good and evil gets wiped out altogether for us too, when the moralities are naturally and simply observed. You might wonder why I say that. You might think, but that means what you are saying is that the person shall be good and have no evil about him. If the moralities are fulfilled perfectly in thought, speech, and action, the ambivalent, dualistic context in which we ordinarily live, is out. And you have only the context of totality, the transcendent context, where comparison has ended. Therefore, for us too, the absolute good is our ordinary good. But that is in the distance, so to say. Meanwhile, we are here and now. Let us inquire, why does the mind interfere? Why is it that the mind is such a slave to our desires, our unquestioned, unchallenged, unexamined, unintelligent desires? The bulk of human desires are rather unintelligent. Why is that the case? Well, the origins of that lie in the body itself, don't they? This physical organism of ours has evolved out of the animal. And the animal lives according to the law of the jungle, which is a good law for the jungle. When the lion leaps upon the antelope, he is just following out law. This is not an act of killing with malice aforethought, which is the English legal definition for murder. There's no malice aforethought about it at all. This is his food. And the instincts which are embedded in the lion's body make him act thus when all the stimuli are there. And having killed one antelope, he has finished. You take a hunter. Has he finished when he has shot one bird? This is a different matter, isn't it? The animal, then, has to live in such a way that he looks after himself. He serves his own purposes. If he acquires anything for the nest or the lair or whatsoever it is a necessity as such. So he must have a certain degree of acquisitiveness and all the rest of it, all of which comes under the heading of greed. He must have this aggressiveness in order to procure his food, which comes under the heading of hate, resentment, and all the rest of it. And the animal is gloriously ignorant of the transcendent, consciously anyway. He lives in harmony with the divine unknowingly, quite unknowingly. And for us humans, there's the root delusion, this ignorance. So now, this organism has embedded in it all those drives which come under greed, under resentment or aversion or hate, whichever word you like, and delusion. This organism lives by the law of the animal, passionately clinging to life, wanting to survive. In our day and age, we constantly hear that I've got to live. Have I? For me, that is a totally unwarrantable assumption. Why should I? Where is the got to live about it? If I'm alive and living, all right, but if circumstance is against my living, equally all right. Why should I struggle and destroy somebody else or his happiness or well-being, etc., etc., in order that I may live and survive? He may be a better person, more useful to the world. Why should I survive? But you see, this is the animal instinct, isn't it? What does the brain do then? It plans ways and means to protect itself, to survive, to assert itself, to dominate. The aggressive instinct works also as self-assertion, as egoism, and so forth. And so all these things come into our life. And the brain becomes an extraordinarily capable instrument for this kind of living. Then the sort of philosophies that the mind builds up with regard to the questions which arise about oneself and one's environment and society are philosophies which are essentially egocentric, self-centered. We take for granted, I must have this, that and the other, and if the other fellow hasn't got it, well, I'll help him if I can, but otherwise bad luck for him. It is the consciousness of our existence in terms of separateness, of otherness. The animal certainly has to live by that. But man? It's a different story. So you see, the brain develops this way. And we've had some 3 million years or so of heredity, of this hereditary force behind us. Hence the difficulties with regard to living the moralities where the mind is concerned, particularly where the mind is concerned. One might question all this and say, surely this is presenting it a little bit too luridly, the picture is too grey or too black or whatever it is. Is it? If we consider how we steal our pleasures whenever possible, just consider that fact in our life. We can go back to our childhood stage. Mum said, now don't touch that sugar. When mum's not there, sugar is the one thing we shall touch. And not only touch, but put it into another place other than the sugar bowl, where it can never be found again. We steal our pleasures, don't we? Look at boy and girl when they reach adolescence. What do they do? Steal a few pleasures here and there. Nothing else. Well, sometimes they're open about it. But they may be open because of honesty, which is rather rare, and more often open because they have no aesthetic sense. I'll put it gently that way. Stolen pleasure. we are thieves. And if and when human beings indulge blatantly, violently in vice and so forth, this is highway robbery, robbery with violence, is it not? Their pleasures, their expressions, their so-called self-expression is a case of robbery with violence. Only day before yesterday, on TV, they showed an interview with some of these unhappy youngsters who take heroin and so forth. They also showed an interview with various car thieves and smashers up of cars. And there was a man, quite calm, he said, "Oh, I enjoy it, I like it, it's a wonderful sensation, smashing up cars." "But doesn't it worry you that the car is somebody else's property and that you're doing him harm?" He just smiled and said, "Oh, I don't care about that." Are we human or what? They are the exceptions in society, true enough. But there are certain outstanding cases from whom we can learn a lot. We, in our little way, time and again, do that, don't we? Now, present the pleasures. Let us take another aspect. Ideas. We fling about ideas. Whose are they? Are they my own realization, my own vision, what I have discovered through experiment, observation, and so forth? Or is it somebody else's idea which I throw out like that and give the impression that I am the originator of it and make the other person feel a little bit small in consequence? Oh, what a brilliant man that is. You know, he knows such a lot. He's absolutely extraordinary and all the rest of it. He indeed is extraordinary. But there we are. See, we are so blind to ourselves and willfully blind. Outwardly, some of us, in spite of all that, may display a certain calm and balance, give the impression of a strong, silent fellow, you know, somebody whom you can really rely upon, and so forth. But am I really calm inside? Am I carelessly calm? If I can be really at ease, no nervousness, no anxiety, then I'm really calm. Each time I had to give a piano recital, I would lose about 5 years of my life, the quarter of an hour before the recital started. Why? After the first few bars, I was all right. But why that quarter of an hour? Self-esteem, self-concern. I've got to keep up a standard. I've got to do this. What will happen? The whole universe was just centered in I achieving. You see, being like this, we still want God. We still want heaven, nirvana. You see why God has to have grace? Because we certainly don't deserve it. If it was a question of deserving, we'd all be outside. There'd be an endless queue standing by the gates of heaven. Now, this observance of the moralities, therefore. And the problem is the same as the maintenance of attentiveness. It's the same sort of problem. Because the central point in relation to the observance of the moralities is whether we are awake, alert, attentive, or whether we are unmindful, forgetful. Our state of forgetfulness, or the moment of forgetfulness, is our destruction. This forgetfulness, this unawareness. Again, the problem comes up. How is it that we do become suddenly forgetful in the moment of testing? We suddenly get caught. Why? Because the situation is such that this computer brain has seen opportunity for the animal expression. Some little pleasure, some little object to gain, you see, and so forth and so forth. This is the difficulty. We are caught suddenly, and it all upsurges so powerfully that this weak little new something struggling in us to realize the harmonious wholeness is just completely swept aside. We've fallen on the spot. We suddenly grab at the opportunity to do the animalish thing. Now, when we talk this way, we must not imagine that the animal is bad. Far from it, the animal is perfectly good. But if I, as a human, succumb to the good law of the animal, I don't sink down to the level of the animal, but I degrade myself into bestiality, which is not the pure animal life. We use the word animal because this object, this human body, is an animal body. That's a fact of nature, and it has evolved out of the animal. Alright, that is why I keep on using the word animal. But we must be very careful never to insult the animal in our outlook on the animal. Never insult the animal. So you see, this moment of forgetfulness comes in. And the whole problem is how to remain unforgetful. That is the whole problem, which is precisely the problem of being awake, being attentive, and knowing the situation as it is. I think there was another point which we touched upon last time. The root virtue perhaps could be put down as harmlessness, not hurting, not harming. There is the tendency of the strictly theistic religions to put it down in positive terms. They would rather say love, friendliness, or whatever it is, you see. But there's a disadvantage in presenting things in the positive form. And that disadvantage is this. In our experience from birth to the grave, we know what cruelty, what untruthfulness, what resentment, and all the rest of it is. Do we really know the real good, the real love, the real wisdom? That is the point. That is something which is still to come to fruition, but until it comes to fruition, what we do really know, and which makes for the pain and sorrow and problems in our life, is the other side of the coin. We know what harming means. We really know what harming means. And you know how the Buddha said, he who lives not hurting himself, not hurting others, lives with a self, become Brahman. Now you know the Buddha was not given to using, throwing about superlatives. To tell us human beings that if each of us lived not hurting ourselves, not hurting others, not harming others, we lived with a self, become the ultimate, the absolute, the transcendent. You know, we have extraordinary illusions about ourselves. We think we are gentle, kind, harmless folk. We will admit, yes, occasionally I get angry, I get impatient, I feel hateful to somebody, occasionally I burst out with, oh, I could have killed him on the spot, you see, and so forth. But of course, that means nothing. This is my mistake. Have we ever been really observant of just exactly how much I did kill him on the spot? Killed him beyond all possibility of resuscitation with or without transplants. With real anger, with real hate, with real rage. How often have we felt, oh, I wish this or that person was absolutely out of the way. He or she is such a nuisance, such a busybody, such a this, that and the other, and all the vices of that person begin to mount up, and so forth. But it's a really strong feeling in us, isn't it? And all that through our upbringing and education in a civilized society is repressed, well repressed. That psychical energy has not been transmuted. It is just bottled up. It's just held down. And that again is one of the forces which helps that moment of forgetfulness, and we do the wrong thing. And we say, oh, I could have bitten my tongue off for saying such a, what a silly thing for me to have said that, of me to have said that to so and so. Too late. Alright. Look, let's spend just 2 or 3 minutes very quietly seeing oneself, seeing the environment in the completely harmless state. That is to say, just try and get the inner feel of harmlessness and see what happens. The inner feel of harmlessness in our own being and in relation to every other being and thing. Just spend about 3 or 4 minutes. Try and let the feel of harmlessness sweep right through the body-mind organism. What does one notice outstanding there? If that real sense of harmlessness has pervaded one's being, outstandingly what happens? the separate self-consciousness vanishes. The sense of otherness vanishes. The sense of otherness is the perpetually harmful state in which we live. Thou and I, there's a conflict. And if we are civilized social beings, then we see that a right relationship has to be built up. But this is false. The fact of the universe is that the right relationship is already there. It is the universe. You see, there is no enmity in the universe. There is only complete relationship all the time, to which we are not awake. This is the mind, the brain at play, separated the two. And so there's a sense of self and the sense of otherness. And if there is the, if harmlessness like a living spirit just suffuses the whole body and mind, then that sense vanishes. The environment is not separate from the I. We always think in and act in terms of I and the environment. I must impress myself on the environment. Have you noticed how the last 3 or 4 days, constantly the talk about the astronauts has been the conquest of space? The conquest, the conquest, the conquest. Domination. Cruelty, separation. All conquest is the expression of hate. The conquest of the vices in the stiff-lipped moralist is the expression of hate. Have we not seen through history, as a matter of fact, and in fiction too, and there the great writers have most truly portrayed the fact about our nature, the monk, the recluse who strives to maintain a superior morality and conquers his base nature. What is he? He's always a mass of cruelty. And he loathes the person who falls, who gives in. Or he condescendingly has the attitude, oh, I must lift him out of the mire. That saint doesn't know mud, glorious mud. So you see, that selfness. This is the harmful state, isn't it? But if harmlessness really goes right through one, and one awakens to it, then that bitterness of separation is out. And the sweetness of the truth, the state of loving union, which is there perpetually. And that is the truth of the universe. But we are unawake. So that's one thing we may notice. And another thing, we shall suddenly discover this marvelous thing called aloneness. Look, let's spend another minute again. And if we can get the real feel of this harmlessness permeating our whole being, the inner meaning of aloneness will stand revealed. Just get the feel of it. Don't seek the intellectual meaning of the aloneness, but the feel of harmlessness. rest. Do you get it? If intellectual activity has been quiet, you will get it. The awakening to this aloneness. So that's why I first mentioned the disappearance of separate self-consciousness. But if separate self-consciousness has ceased to keep me imprisoned in the dark, so to say, what has happened? In awareness, there is only the total reality. Obviously, the organism as we see it, touch it, see it, hear it, and so forth, as it moves about, is a separate entity in relation to another organism as such. The intellect can say, just put out a string of words, the whole universe is one, all life is one, but they are just words. They become a reality when in the individual human's awareness, this thing has become an of course-ness. It has really got right beyond word and thought. There's no thinking about it. In awareness, what we commonly call you or I, you are it. The being of a human is the totality of the universe. That is his real being. And if he awakens to that, all the limitations imposed upon any one person by the becoming process are out. He will have pleasure, pain, and all the rest of it as separate events. They will take place. But this center of awareness will be the enlightened awareness. It will be the shining light within. As the Buddha said, for instance, the vinyanam anidassanam anantam sabbato bhavam. That consciousness which is attributeless and therefore invisible, if it has no attributes, it is invisible, anantam, endless, infinite, eternal, if you like, you see. Sabbato, everywhere, bhavam, shining, shining. Not a darkness. So now, the aloneness is realized through the individual being, the separate being, whose separateness is maintained by the fact of his brain being there operating. My brain is not your brain is not somebody else's brain, and so on. Each one's brain is each one's brain. That is the sort of material root of apparent difference. In fact, of actual material difference. But not difference in terms of awareness of totality. See, this is the thing we are always moving to. Religion is concerned with the transcendent. The heart of religion is transcendence. And transcendence does not mean an other than this. It is convenient to talk in terms of the transcendent and the immanent and all the rest of it. But whilst these words are very delightful to use insofar as they titivate our intellects and give us great intellectual pleasure, they are awful misguiders to grow into this awareness. And then, when one has really grown into it, it becomes such a power that it now becomes the overriding influence in our everyday life. Then the moment of forgetfulness has no chance to be there. So, this aloneness, if The separate self-consciousness, which implies the otherness, and therefore duality or multiplicity and conflict and confusion and all the rest of it, if that is out, there is only one. And if there are not two, one is alone. This is the meaning of the aloneness, isn't it? See, forget the words. Get the feel of the fact. Let it grow in awareness. Take any one thing you like. Any one thing. And if you attend to it in the right way, just with pure attention, perfectly quiet. That is to say, a quietness which doesn't exclude movement in the mind, provided it takes place perfectly naturally and sweetly, not desire-driven, not planned out. See? With the mind quiet, then the totality shines through the particular. In this way, the heart of religion is understood, is realized, made real in our lives. Any one thing can do it. Don't be concerned about achieving it. That is the way to defeat the thing. There are many flaws in the verbal formulations of the scriptures. Many, many flaws in the verbal formulations. You remember we considered this some months ago. The Buddha says, I won the unborn, the unaging, the undying. Nirvana. The individual being, the finite, cannot win the infinite. And winning implies conflict. Not release. It implies conquest. It implies wrong relationship. Moreover, the actual form in which this puts, seeking the unborn. You can't seek the unborn. You can seek that which you know what you're looking for. You already have to know it. If you don't know it, you can't seek it. If you say you are seeking it, when you come across it, you won't recognize it. It's quite impossible. The unborn is the absolutely new, the unknown. We don't know what it is. So it cannot be sought. But you can be in the state of search, which is a different thing. When you seek deliberately, the intellect has come into play. The brain has formulated a picture. And the brain can formulate a picture only out of the storehouse of its past experience. The new, the transcendent, the eternal, the immortal cannot come within this purview. It doesn't. But if this, all this is quiet and offers no obstruction, then the immortal just naturally is there. Again and again, my good old simile, you can't put cleanness into the room, you can remove the dirt, and the room is clean. Get free of the mortality, and the immortality is there. You can't go for immortality. Get free of the limitations of samsara, of dukkha, and nirvana is there. That's all. It cannot be bought, sold, touched, tasted, anything. It is there. You see, any one of the moralities, this basic morality of not harming, which is presented in the Judeo-Christian tradition as the commandment, thou shalt not kill. It's presented in the theistic religions in a rather more dramatic form, generally. In the non-theistic aspects of Hinduism and the straightforwardly non-theistic Buddhist teaching, there are no commandments, there are just advices. They say, if you are concerned with the truth, with nirvana, then you will find that this will be helpful. That's all. That's how it is put.
Well, that is why a lot of people consider that Christianity is positive and Buddhism
is negative. This,
because of this, these two perspectives.
This is the
positive
faith. Yes. This is the intellect functioning within the ambivalent sphere. Thou shalt not. You see? The positive statement, thou shalt not kill, the negative statement, avoid harming. This is the ambivalence here. But if the avoid harming, or the other way around, the thou shalt not kill or hurt, you see, thou shalt not, the positive commandment, you see, if either of them is fully attended to and completely fulfilled, the duals are transcended. You see, this is what makes possible for the imperfect to grow into perfection. If it were a question of one or the other in absolute terms, there'd be no end to that everlasting separation and conflict. But because these two are bound together like this, this good-evil, as we call it, interplaying, thou shalt not kill, avoid harming, you see, because they are bound together, they are in interplay with each other, the complete attention on the one, the complete realization of the one, takes the realization out of the sphere of both, into the transcendent reality. For which again we use the words love, truth, beauty, and so forth. But this is very important, the moralities. Take another aspect of it. Why is it that the observance of the moralities is somewhat half-hearted? We approach the moralities often in a little bit in the spirit of compromise. Oh, well, never mind. Let's have a fling today. Tomorrow will be good. Because we do not really care for the transcendent. If you really wanted to be a tennis champion or a concert artist or whatever it is, what do? Everything else goes by the board. You are a natural ascetic. Everything that is unnecessary for the fulfillment of perfection just drops away out of your life. The telephone goes, oh, do come and have tea and dinner with us. We are having so and so and so and so. Thank you very much, my dear. I'm sorry, but I can't. I've got to, because you've got a greater purpose. The transcendent is not our purpose. It is not the object of our love in the true sense. It is not sufficiently the object of our love. You know, we have considered this more than once in the past. Why do we turn to religion? dope to alleviate the pain.
Dope comes in sometimes?
All that comes into it, yes, of course. But it is not, the transcendent is not sought because of love. The love which brings that element of courseness about it. There is nothing else to do but this. But this is a fact, isn't it? And you see, this is so much a fact that the organized aspects of all the religions use every possible enticement to draw people into the religious fold. You will get this, that, and the other most desirable result. But that is quite wrong. When you really love, does anything, do you need any inducement? If, for instance, one is in love with the wrong person, as the clear-headed outsider would say, oh, he's making a mistake or she's making a mistake, that's the wrong person. Of course, they are quite right in what they say. But if they really love, they are mad in love, aren't they? But it's a divine madness, that one. I don't mean the sort of passion which insists that it must be satisfied. I don't mean that. I mean the real thing. That is why it is so absolutely rare. It may happen once in 10 centuries, perhaps, in the human world. But when it does happen, that is the revelation of the divine. If we seek the transcendent in order to alleviate our suffering, in order to gain something, we are in the harmful state. We are in the deathful state. The state, by that I mean the state in which death as the wages of sin comes to us. I don't mean just physical death. Oh, no, no. That will come in any case. Every incarnate deity has died physically. Krishna was incarnate, Lord of the universe. He died. All the other teachers the same. Let's have no illusions about that. But this death inside the soul, the mind and the heart, but actually the mind and the heart can everlastingly grow more and more youthful, more and more innocent, more and more powerful. Powerful in the right way. If and when there is the real love of the transcendent, if and when the simple moralities are naturally and sweetly and easily fulfilled in our lives, then we will awaken to the power that lies locked up in the very body. In this body, which is our problem and our trouble, the animal body, all these drives which have distorted the mind, no longer distort the mind, and then the power locked up in the pure physical body becomes available in mental realms. You know how the great religions have talked about all kinds of extraordinary powers and miracles which can be performed. Ideas like levitation and so forth, you see. These are all symbolic ways of talking of mental powers which depend upon the body, bodily existence. Because the energy required for the performance of those mental things is derived out of the body. Don't let's go into that on that track. First, let's get our bases right. So now, this calm and insight. We all race after meditations and or rituals and so on to induce a state of calm, you see, and then we hope for insight and vision and whatnot. All right, practice the methods and see what happens. See, sometimes it may be a necessity to use a particular technique because the pressures of life in our modern world are so terrific, they are so shattering, we are battered day and night by all the turmoil and bustle and the actual evil constantly around us. We are battered by it all the time. You see, that is perfectly true. Therefore, do use an alleviative technique as and when necessary. But if when you do use an alleviative technique, let us take the simple little bit of dope, you know, just sit quietly and breathe and pay attention to your breathing in and out. Of course you will feel a little bit quiet, but be awake to the fact that this is a temporary alleviation. The calm, the reality of the calm, has at its basis the living morality of everyday life. In not only merely in physical action, but in speech and in thought. See, that way happiness will emerge. You will find extraordinary happiness in life. And let us make no mistake about it. Happiness is the crown of our organic existence. But that happiness is not to be defined in the world's ways. The world knows nothing of that happiness. Occasionally it gets a touch of it. And sometimes even that is a misfortune because the memory of that hurts afterwards. I can't have it again. See, that's tragedy, isn't it? But this real happiness is the crown of our organic existence. And you will find that it will be associated with the release of intelligence. By intelligence, not just intellectual, this computer brain's abilities, but the power to see the truth of things as and when they appear constantly. Insight, in other words. The crown of our spiritual being, of course, is freedom. What is that freedom above all? Freedom from the sense of selfness and otherness. We say the spirit is one. We say it. Our petty little brains don't know at all what it really means. The brain uses the words and fools itself into thinking, oh yes, I know that self and not self really are one. Do I? Haven't begun tonight. But when we do know, say in Plato's sense of the word know, and certainly in the Sanskrit meaning of the word vidya, to see the fact as a fact, you see. When we really know that we are it. Awareness and being are identical. He who knows God has become God. This has been said by, not merely by in the Upanishads and such things, but by the Christian mystics themselves. And Christian theology has always kept the separation very strong between God, the holy other, the creator, and man, the creature, the created. Absolutely kept them apart and put the link as Jesus Christ, the grace of God, and all that sort of thing. Who was it who said it? Erigena? One of the people during the first 1,000 years, Alluhita. He who knows God has become God. And of course, Eckhart very strongly held all these, taught all these things. He really saw, he did. So there is that. The morality, the simple morality. But you practice this for the coming fortnight and see. If during the last fortnight you had really paid attention to this, you would have discovered something, wouldn't you?
How a man who believes in the Buddhist religion can ever be liberated in the sense that we use the word in Buddhism?
Yes. Well, can't. If the intellect will predetermine that God is there, there is no liberation possible. You will always put God there. Away.
Well, how did Eckhart come to be?
All those great ones, Eckhart, Tauler, Ruysbroeck, Dionysius the Areopagite, several of them, quite 8 or 10 of them at least. They weren't bound by the dogmas of the church. They knew through their inner realization this is all nonsense. But they had to be very careful how they wrote. Ruysbroeck, I don't know why I can't pronounce his name properly. Ruysbroeck, isn't it? Ruysbroeck. Ruysbroeck wrote with a freedom which is absolutely amazing. And how on earth it ever slipped through the authoritarian. Oh yes, all of them were Catholics. There have been very few non-Catholic Christian mystics of a very high order.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I'm aware, they have all been Catholic.
Yeah.
A Greek Catholic, Eastern Church, Dionysius the Areopagite, or the Roman Church. George Fox and such people were mystics, but I mean. No, there wasn't that realization. When you read their life, see what they, how they lived, how they spoke, and how they presented their teaching, and you will see all these. Of course, one can't see the drawbacks unless oneself has gone beyond them. Oneself has to have the power of seeing. You see the 11 plus laddie cannot set an examination paper to the university professor. It's the other way about, always. That has to be borne in mind. Do you remember last time, I think, I said, see if there is any one thing in connection with the moralities which we can really look into during the fortnight and be completely free of it. Well, did we? During the fortnight? Be completely free of it. Or did we find ourselves stuck fast in the same spot? This is where the intensity of the attentiveness comes in. We do get opportunities, even in our busy modern life. We do get opportunities. And it's not a question of time. It can happen like that, if the intensity is there, or you can just go on for hours at a stretch and get nowhere. But if the intensity of the observation is there, the whole being is centered upon it, and you see that this is unnecessary. You see? And that unnecessary may be an item of wrong conduct, bodily or in speech or in thought, you see, then it drops away from you. It drops away from you. You don't conquer it. It drops away from you altogether. Like a bit of diseased skin which falls off, you see. It just drops away from you like that. And then you find, not that you've moved forward, this is another illusion which we all suffer from, but you're standing on the same spot, but not stuck fast there. You are standing free on that same spot. What's this idea about moving forward and making progress? Didn't the psalmist say so beautifully, if I make my bed in Sheol, thou art there. I may look or go or be, thou art there. Well, then stay here. Much more comfortable. Have dinner together right in your own home with the transcendent.
Very often the mother sees the woman or the woman currently there, but once a week they fall into the old habit pattern of attacking oneself, saying that, you know, you see what you're doing, but instead of just seeing it and looking at it, you tend to say, oh, this is wrong, then you start attacking yourself and can't get anything.
When one sees the thing for what it is, don't pass judgment upon it. See it with the clarity of vision and understanding which the judge in the court has with respect to both sides of the case. You see? But you pass no judgment. You see the truth. And in that seeing of the truth in perfect calm and quiet, you see, you have disentangled the self from all the confusion and folly and wickedness and whatever it is. And that is the liberty.
I know, but it's not that it's perfect. One doesn't do this. One attacks oneself instead. Very often.
Live without hurting the self. Don't attack the self. See, hurting the self is a very pleasurable thing. It's an inverted form of pleasure. It's a perverted pleasure, isn't it? We talk of sex perversions and all the rest of it. But we have perversions in every field of our life. The thing inverts and it's a perversion. And we indulge in it. We have great pleasure in it. When we really see it as such, see it quite clearly, just keep on seeing it quietly until the point comes when you know in your own mind, ah, this is falling away now. This is another way of realizing the aloneness. Isn't there that marvelous thing in the Christian Mass? Keep your hearts and minds in the love and knowledge of God.
Yes.
Yes. You see? If we care for the transcendent, let that care emerge. You can't love to order. Not even the transcendent. can't love God.
But be aware, just be aware. The love of the cancer, the love of truth, the love of blessing, it will emerge.
Well, see what happens during the coming fortnight. Now look, next fortnight we'll meet here in the usual way, and the fortnight after, and the fortnight after, as far as the Sunday and Saturday meetings are concerned. It's only with the Friday meetings that there'll be a difference. Friday meeting next fortnight will take place, but the Friday after that, which is Friday the 15th of August, there'll be no meeting on the Friday. I can't come back in time from our little summer school, you see, and do the needful.